As was mentioned, I've been studying for about 12 years now, Buddhism, and been meditating for about that long. And I also am an avid reader of science, cognitive science included, and I like a lot of what's been going on recently between people like the Dalai Lama and other Buddhist monks and Buddhist leaders in their conferences and talks with cognitive scientists. We're learning a lot more about how the brain works and how the effects of meditation on the brain. And what science tells us about our minds, along with what Buddhism tells us about our minds. And it's really fascinating to see those two realms interacting with one another. So today I'll talk about consciousness framed within Buddhism and how it's framed within science, and compare and contrast a little. So as I do this, we'll be going back and forth between two very different kinds of investigation. One is a first-person investigation of consciousness, which is Buddhism. In Buddhism, we investigate consciousness as conscious beings from the inside out. And modern science is a third-person investigation. You put instruments on brains, and you take readings, and you're kind of outside-in investigation. And these two different ways of investigating consciousness have different strengths and weaknesses, and they have different parameters. There's certain things you wouldn't investigate, or there's certain conclusions you wouldn't draw from a first-person investigation, and vice versa. Neither will ever replace the other. They're both important. So I think it's important to begin by defining what I mean when I say consciousness. Now, what I'm going to describe isn't necessarily the definition of consciousness, but all that's important is that it's the one I'm using when I say the word today, so that we communicate clearly with one another. Buddhism describes the eight consciousnesses. The first five are the five senses: eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose, tongue, body consciousness. These are the kind of things we're conscious of from those sensory perceptions. The sixth is our mental consciousness. The seventh is the subconscious, or feelings. And the eighth is the storehouse, the larger grand consciousness of which we were all a part. So when I talk about consciousness today, I'm going to be addressing what is trying to be investigated in neuroscience. And let me maybe approach this by saying what consciousness is not. By consciousness, I'm not talking about memory. Your memories about past events, that's not consciousness. I'm not talking about narrative thought, like when you're thinking to yourself, oh, I've got to go to the store today, or that was a great movie, or why does that person hate me, or any of those kinds of things. I'm not talking about knowledge. You know, the War of 1812, or the capital of Louisiana, or anything like that. I'm not talking about sensation, even. When we, if I see an apple on a desk, consciousness is not the having the data that there is an apple on the desk. And I'm not talking about a sense of self-awareness, the knowledge that you exist and that you're thinking of yourself as an entity. That's one of the things that they work on in artificial intelligence, for example, trying to figure out how to give machines a sense of self-awareness. That, too, is not what I mean by consciousness. So what I mean by consciousness is the pure experience of existence. The philosopher David Chalmers is known in the field for coming up with a distinction between what he calls the easy problem of consciousness and the hard problem of consciousness. And so the easy question of consciousness would be what a lot of cognitive scientists tend to gravitate toward. And by that, what I mean is they look at neurons and how neurons fire and interconnect with one another. And then they say, okay, this impulse leads to that, this mechanism leads to that, and therefore we have knowledge coming in, data coming into the brain, which affects it in these ways, which causes these neurotransmitters to activate, which then eventually leads to action. These are all mechanistic functions, exactly the kind of thing you would expect a scientist to study from a third-person perspective. Chalmers calls that the easy question of consciousness because it's just looking at function. But he came up with a really neat thought experiment. And it's a concept called a philosophical zombie, or a zombie in the philosophical sense. And what you imagine is you think, okay, if you got a person and you prick that person with a pin and they yell out from the pain, you could imagine every step of that process from the pin prick to the yelling, all of the things, the impulses traveling up the nerves, all of the activity that goes on in the brain, leading to the mouth opening, the lungs contracting, the sound coming out. You could imagine that entire picture as this one big elaborate mechanism, but yet there is no one having a first-person experience. It's just a mechanism doing these things. A very complex mechanism, but there's no one home. There's no inner first-person experience. You could imagine that structure, that creature existing. And for all we know, there could be people who are like that. And you ask them, are you conscious? And they say, yes, I'm conscious. Do you really feel this? Yes, I feel this. And they say everything they're supposed to say, and they act in every mechanistic way that you would expect a person to act, and yet inside there's nothing being experienced the way we know we experience reality. Now, this is a fictional thought experiment, but what it shows is that it highlights the question, why isn't the universe like that? Because we know that things are composed of particles, atoms, physics, the laws of nature interacting. All of that could take place without a first-person experience. And so Chalmers says the hard question of consciousness is why any of these mechanisms should lead to a first-person experience and not simply be mechanisms, mindless mechanisms. So even if we understood all of the neuroscience, everything that went on in the brain down to the last particle, we still would not have answered that question. Why any group of atoms should ever, no matter how complex their interactions, lead to a first-person experience. A pure state of being, a state of awareness of the moment, a sensation of what it is like to be that thing. There is something it is like to be a person. There is probably something it is like to be a dog. There is something it is like to be a mouse. Is there something it is like to be a storm? Is there something it is like to be the planet, a galaxy, a blade of grass? There is something going on there that's not just mechanism. That's what Chalmers calls the hard question of consciousness. And he calls that qualia. That's the philosophic word for it. Qualia is not the data of what's going on around you. It's not the awareness there's a room here and lights and a clock and all these things. Qualia is just that pure experience of isness, of suchness. And what's interesting is I learned talking with a researcher, Susan Blackmore, who's a consciousness researcher and writer, and she informed me that David Chalmers does not meditate. And I was very surprised to learn that, because the things he talks about are the kinds of things you start to see in meditation. When you do meditation and you set aside your literal thought, your linguistic thought, you set that aside, you set aside labels, you set aside all of these preoccupations and activities, and you set aside a great deal of the sensations around you, and you start to see just the experience of the present moment without thought or distraction or memory or these kinds of things. And so you get an idea of what that is, and that's what he's talking about when he says qualia. Because you can imagine a robot taking in data and saying and doing everything we do without qualia, without a sense of existence. Now, some people respond to consciousness by saying, some researchers, one is Daniel Dennett, and he's written a book about to explain consciousness, and his answer is basically to deny that consciousness exists, to say that it's an illusion, a trick that our brains play on us. And he has what he calls the multiple drafts theory of consciousness. And what he says is that there's no specific area of the brain or moment at which thoughts become conscious or enter consciousness. Instead, the whole thing is an illusion. There are countless sensory inputs entering and becoming one of many possible sources of our behavior, a big system. And the whole picture, that where it's brought together on a stage like a theater and creates this whole picture, that whole picture of our reality, the thing we are said to be conscious of, is only assembled after the fact, even after we've acted on it. The different areas of our neural network assert various levels of control at different times. Something becomes what we call conscious when that subset of functions emerges into great prominence in the overall brain system. It's somewhat like when a person becomes popular or influential in society. We remember the event even if a microsecond later, because it has altered the network to a sufficient degree that this creates the illusion of awareness during the moment. Which sensations are edited into our draft of events is not an act of supervision. It is a self-organizing bottom-up function of the network. Now, Dennett claims that this shows that Chalmers' qualia simply does not exist. Consciousness itself is an illusion. Now, in one sense, Dennett's rendition recalls the Buddhist realization that the self is not a single unchanging thing, but a collection of aggregates. In fact, the description is strikingly similar to the no-self concept. Dennett says the self is a story we tell ourselves about our experiences. Almost verbatim quotable of the Buddha. But at the same time, this framing of consciousness would seem to negate the very central Buddhist concept of even the possibility of awareness of the present moment. It would also seem to be opposed to the notion that consciousness is the underlying and ultimate reality to which Buddhists look. Dennett illustrates some highly fascinating aspects of how the brain works, which have been soundly backed up by experimental data and written about by many others. In other words, experimental data has shown that many of the things we do in our brain, or the things we do with our brain, they happen before we are conscious of them. You ask a person, pick a random number between 1 and 10. Their brain has already picked the number before they think they picked the number. So they believe they made the choice to pick the number, when really the brain picked the number and then informed our consciousness that it happened, and we feel like we did it. So that has soundly been backed up by experimental data. So these are very useful observations. Yet, I do not see here that Dennett's multiple drafts theory has negated qualia or shown consciousness to be an illusion. All he has done is describe what is called the neural correlates of consciousness. It is not important that there's a small delay between the events and our awareness of them, or that the awareness comes to us through an assembled microsecond-old memory. The very mechanism Dennett describes may simply be the way and the reason we experience consciousness. In short, to experience the illusion of consciousness, one must have an experience, and that experience is consciousness. So by definition, consciousness cannot be an illusion. Then it says this is like the Catholic claim of papal infallibility. But the claim isn't that something, some particular thing we are conscious of is infallible. Or that it's like we think it is. For example, that there's a door in front of me. But merely that I'm having some kind of experience of being. I can be wrong about the door, but I cannot be wrong that I'm experiencing a door. And that alone constitutes qualia. But I also get the sense that Dennett may be thinking that qualia or consciousness requires dualism of some sort, or some other kind of ghost in the machine. I am not a dualist, but I'm a naturalist. I think it's consistent with Buddhism that all things are interconnected. Our natural world seems to me to be a sufficient canvas for consciousness to emerge. Yet it is clear that there is something that needs explaining which is not explained by the individual interactions in the brain. There is a first-person experience, and the question remains why any group of atoms, no matter how complex, should cause that to emerge. Science does provide an approach to this, but not fields of science which all researchers have yet really utilized. Before I get into that field of science, let me note some important aspects of Buddhism that preceded it. In the Pali Canon, a distinction is made between that which has a clear and plain meaning and that which can be misleading unless deeply explained and understood. In Mahayana Buddhism, the two truths doctrine distinguishes between conventional truth and ultimate truth. In the West, ancient Stoic philosophy says, not all that is real exists. That phrase requires a little unpacking, but to put it another way, reality, capital R reality, consists of that which, two categories, that which exists and that which subsists. And so existing things can be held in the hand, put on a scale, etc. Dennett may be believing that the only alternative to consciousness being an illusion is it existing as a parallel phenomenon. Yet subsisting things are those which subsist on the interactions and relationships of existing things. In Buddhism, we speak of no self. This is ultimate truth. But we also say, I will meditate today. How can I meditate if there is no I? That's conventional truth. And by conventional truth, there is you and I. Democracy is real. It is a part of reality. Waves are real. Constellations are real. Nations are real. Ethics is real. Yet none of these things can be put on a scale, photographed separately from their interactions which produce them, and so on. Consciousness, likewise, is not something like a soul that can be separated or stand alone or migrated. As discussed by Simmias to Socrates in Plato's Euthyphro, the soul is like an attunement on an instrument. And so, the field of science that I mentioned earlier that hasn't really been accessed as much by the by these particular researchers is called complex systems theory. It's a relatively new field of science, and it's designed specifically to understand these kinds of things. In complexity science, one of its concepts is emergence. Before I get to that, let me just elucidate a little bit more about complexity science. Complex systems theory is designed to study things that are basically interconnected, interdependent webs of interaction. That can be things like human brains, it can be societies, it can be an ecology, it can be a storm system, it can be a galaxy. There are all kinds, it can be an economy. Anything where you have interacting components that are very tightly interconnected in this causal network. And so these kinds of systems have some very interesting properties to them. That's what complex systems theory studies, the mathematics and the principles of those kinds of systems. And there's a concept, one of the many concepts in complexity science is called emergence. Emergence is similar to the Buddhist concept of dependent origination. That is, properties that emerge out of complex interactions of many simultaneous causes working in conjunction. What's fascinating about these properties is that they do not exist at lower levels of their operational components. Wetness, air pressure, temperature, are all properties which cannot be found in the individual particles of those systems. They are irreducible. Or to put it in Buddhist terms, these aggregates themselves are empty of such properties. This begins to build a picture of how the conventional truth of a self and the ultimate truth of a no-self that is a collection of aggregates can both be simultaneously legitimate. In fact, one of Chalmers' proposals is that perhaps consciousness is what complexity science calls an emergent property. Further, it may be that all complex interactions in the universe create various levels of conscious experience, however rudimentary. I emailed with Chalmers once and asked for some clarifications about his theories, and he wrote back to me, "Are you saying that to some extent, a thermostat might have a conscious first-person experience?" And he said that you can't rule that out. It could be that a system like a thermostat, which very simply takes in information, adjusts its behavior according to the information, and has an output, that there might be some level of consciousness in systems like this. And by this, it would be a mistake to think that it's something like the thermostat is sitting on the wall thinking about what it is. It knows its self. Like I said earlier, consciousness is not self-awareness. It's not memory. It's not thoughts. It's not bored that all it gets to do is adjust the air conditioner. It doesn't have opinions about it. But when you think about that pure, simple state of being, state of experience, is there some basic rudimentary experience that a thermostat may have. It's fascinating to think about, but if we believe that our brains have produced consciousness, then that in itself is where the fascinating, extraordinary claim began, because we're saying that a group of atoms, which are no different than the atoms in this cushion or anything else, simply by their arrangement and activity, have brought forth a first-person experience. And once you make that claim, you then have to look at storms and thermostats and everything else in the universe. So there's another researcher. His name is Giulio Totoni, and he has created a fascinating theory called the Integrated Information Theory of Consciousness. It's a very mathematical paper. I've read through it, and I don't understand all. The math was way over my head, but fortunately, he explains what each of these stages of his theory are talking about so that a person can get it in a conceptual level. So this integrated information theory of consciousness, the way it works is when you look at systems as information, there's this thing that you can measure with complex formulas, which is a measure of how integrated the information is. By integrated, we mean there's a bunch of information that's very tightly causally linked with other parts in the system. One thing happens here, it affects this over here, and so on. Now, of course, the whole world is that way, but when you get a specific system set up such that it's interacting with its other components, without it all being just mixed together like a soup, but yet there's these highly controlled packets of information that are interacting in very systematic ways. So there is a way to mathematically measure how integrated information is. A low measurement, and it's called the phi scale, PHI. So a low phi would be like a soup, would be like just a chaotic group of materials. Or it could be like a rock. We have a very low phi rating. A phi rating that's very would be higher would be something like the red spot on Jupiter, which is a massive storm. Something to be even higher than that would be like a biological organism, like a cricket. And then as the system becomes more and more complex, more and more integrated, the phi factor goes up. And what's interesting about this is that these formulas that he's come up with, they seem to match the kind of data relationships that go on in the brain when we go through different levels of our conscious awareness. Like when we go to sleep, there are certain characteristics of the way the data moves around in our brain that if they were plugged into his formulas, would produce a lower phi rating, lower consciousness, and vice versa. So it's an intriguing idea, but it can't be literally applied. It's more of a conceptual idea, because if you were to actually do the calculations on a brain, it would take you like longer than the universe exists to come up with a real mathematical answer. But conceptually, at least, it illustrates a very interesting concept, which is that the more complex and integrated and causally linked a system is, the more experienced conscious sense of being that system may have. Now, that makes a lot of sense. We don't know it for a fact, but it makes a lot of sense, and it's very fascinating. Now, the problem is that, as fascinating as that theory is, Totoni's theory still doesn't do certain things. It doesn't explain why a sense of being would emerge from integrated information. It just provides one possible way that it could happen, or one possible thing that leads to it. But it doesn't explain why. And Chalmers has some ideas about this. He says, well, maybe fact that consciousness arises in proportion to the integration of information is simply a fundamental property of the universe. So in physics, there are things called fundamental properties. In other words, they're the bottom of the bottom layer. You know, you say this happens because of this, this happens because of this, all the way down to the fundamental properties, such as the cosmological constant, or the fact that gravity exists. Or, you know, you get to these points where you're why, and you hit a dead end. It's just, that's the way the universe is. That's the way it works. And there's no experiment you can conduct to explain it. It's just a fundamental property of existence, a fundamental property of reality. If that's true, then it's remarkably similar to what Buddhism says about consciousness. And I meant to mention, too, that these causally interconnected systems are also highly similar in the descriptions of karma. Karma is causation, complex systems of causation. This kind of framework also explains what might be a way to look at rebirth, for example. In Buddhism, you have rebirth, but at the same time, there's no self. So what is it that migrates? Well, if you look at this in terms of a complex system, these patterns can continue to emerge and come out of previous operations of the system, and yet nothing has actually transferred from past to future. It's kind of like another concept in complex systems theory is called autopoiesis. And that's basically the idea of you've got a seaworthy ship, and then it gets damaged, and so you replace some of the boards on the ship. And then later the sails get damaged, so you replace the sails, and then later the rudder, and you replace the rudder. And this whole time, you've had a ship. And you might say, well, the ship is now 20 years old, but none of the materials are the materials that were in the original ship. So this replacement of things. This also goes on in organisms. They say that every 7 years, you know, you've already completely replaced all of your particles in the body. But yet, the patterns persist. And so patterns of one life can reemerge in the future and other lives, and yet nothing solid has gone from one to the other. So it's very interesting how these concepts overlap that are emerging in science and Buddhism. And that's one of the reasons I like Buddhism, because all of these different fields that I've been describing, these different theories and these different scientific experiments and everything, they're all preceded by the realizations in Buddhism. It came thousands of years before, and yet maybe use different terms, maybe approach it at a different kind of perspective or a different level of resolution, but are obviously looking at the very same kinds of phenomenon and coming to similar conclusions. That's what's exciting. And so these formulations of Buddhism seem to be general enough to apply and serve as an underlayment to effective practice, even in today's scientific world. So knowing the science of this can help to further elucidate our comprehension, and should not be not only be welcomed, but it should be integrated. I think this is the beginning of what people like the Dalai Lama are trying to do in conversations with scientists. Ultimately, though, it may seem abstract or somewhat esoteric even, but ultimately, by understanding these things and trying to explore them, this can create kind of a backdrop to our personal practice. It can be a part of right understanding, as we continue to look and investigate. And that's what we're told to do in Buddhism, is to not accept things simply on doctrine, but to look, investigate, explore for ourselves. So that's a lot of different things that I touched on briefly there about consciousness. And hopefully I've related them to Buddhist concepts, at least that in ways that seem to make sense to me. But so after all that, I'm kind of curious to see if anybody wants to go back and discuss any portion of that more, or if you have questions about it. So we've got about 25 minutes left, and so that's plenty of time for discussion and everything. And really, with a group this size, it makes discussion a lot easier. So anyway, thank you for listening to all that. And let me know, does anybody want to talk about any specific part of it or have more questions? Yeah. Yeah, I think in Buddhism, the seventh consciousness is kind of what we call the subconscious today, and the feelings and everything. And that, I mean, you look at all of this as a complex system. The part where we talk about it, the talking part, is really just the most simplistic tip of the iceberg of what's really going on, even when we talk to ourselves. In fact, that, I think, is one of the things that meditation does for us, is that we're in our minds, we're talking to ourselves all the time. We're saying, oh, this is the way this is what I think about this is the way I need to do this, I need to do that. And there's this little narrator. And so it's just simplifying into language and abstracting reality for us all the time, so that we never actually get to directly experience the reality of existence, as long as we're caught up in that. And when you look at complex systems and how they operate, they're complex. They're very, very complex and very, very sort of way more complex than language could capture. But you know, that's the irony we're stuck in. And that's why, you know, especially in Zen, they emphasize that truth is not to be found in the words or the language. And yet, the Pali Canon is one of the most voluminous collection of words there is. And so that's kind of ironic that there's all this text, all this language, all this talking about that which cannot be talked about. But it's pretty much just our limitation as human beings that we like to put things into those little packages of words and send them to each other and hope that the person who gets the package has some idea what we're talking about. Yeah, exactly. I feel like some of the things that Dennett said in his theories come from the fact that he doesn't meditate. I think that most of his criticisms of qualia, as Chalmers calls it, they seem to not really be understanding what he means by qualia. Like he'll say, for example, Dennett will critique qualia by pointing out something you could be mistaken about in what you think is happening. Like, You know, like somebody performs a magic trick in front of you, and you thought that the person was in the box, and then they cut the lady in half, but it wasn't true, and so your senses can be fooled. And so he thinks that that's disproving qualia in some way, because your senses can be fooled. So it doesn't feel like he's getting it, like he really knows what qualia is trying to address. And I think that if he were engaged in these kind of practices from a first-person perspective, instead of only doing the scientific third-person perspective, it would be a little bit more, I see what they're trying to say. And maybe he wouldn't agree still, but I think he would, at least his criticisms would be more on target and less of a straw man. Kind of after the fact summary. Yeah.
And within the heart can come intention. And so if I can go into a place that I intend, community consciousness can bring it about. If it is pure, if it purely comes from that.
Yes. Yeah, it's challenging. I think that in Stoicism, they say that all pain, what they really mean is pathos, mental illness, comes from misjudgment. And these misjudgments are unconscious. And so we unpack that and try to examine the judgments we're making on a second-to-second level. Everything that happens to us constantly, as we go through it, we're making judgments about. And we're not always aware that we're making those judgments. So in Buddhism, when we meditate, by setting that aside, of course, different types of meditation, but when we focus on the breath, these things that, sometimes I call them distractions, that they actually tend to be the point. Because while you're focusing on the breath, the things that emerge tell you something about yourself. They tell you what's on your mind, what you're really thinking. By examining those, maybe not in the meditation, maybe after, unless it's a kind of meditation where you're exploring them. But in some sense, by examining the brain from within, examining the mind from within, you can see what emerges out of that subconscious area. You can see what naturally starts to emerge, and you start to get a better understanding of the judgments you're making, the subconscious judgments you're making about things. For example, worry. Something's going to happen that's beyond our control, or it's not going to happen. We don't know. The not knowing is the important part. And that causes us to worry. Not responsible concern, where you have to think about what may happen and then take precautions and do your actions. You can always tell the difference between worry and concern by the ability to do productive things in response to it. So if you're concerned that you might get in a wreck, you put on your seatbelt. That's rational, reasonable concern. But if you're worried that you know, an asteroid is going to fall on your house. There's nothing to do about it, you know. So the fact that you hit this wall and you can't do anything about it, that shows that you're now worrying. So when you examine the worry, what you'll find is there's always a misjudgment somewhere in your thinking. And the misjudgment in this case would be that I have more control than I do over a situation. Or that by engaging in a flustered, worry state of mind, I am doing something productive to help negate the thing from happening or keep it from happening because I'm worried. And so all of those are false conclusions. They're misjudgments. And so I think in Buddhism, what we do is as we examine ourselves, we get to know ourself better. In Greek philosophy, know thyself was a major big thing in Socratic school. As we know thyself, we can start to unveil these misjudgments. And I mean something even deeper than, you know, what you said. Like, you're obviously aware that certain foods are not good for you, but it doesn't take away the craving. And so that's an intellectual awareness, but the more we practice, rather than just talking like we're talking right now, but actually practice, sitting and doing the practices, engaging in the activities, the more we do that, the more that goes from being just a simple linguistic intellectual knowledge to being a deep intuitive knowledge that could either penetrate downward or come from underneath. And when that happens, our actions begin to match reality. We start the nature of our character, the nature of our being, the way we respond to the world starts to shift to match the truth of reality, the Dharma, so that we naturally then act as a sane, rational person would act in the truth of that world that we're in. And the subconscious, you know, merging the two, like you said, the subconscious and the conscious, we've got to start by, you know, right seeing, you know, we've got to start by being able to move away those delusions and see through them so that our conscious mind can start to be informed by that subconscious to what's really going on. I think you had it. Sure. That's a Buddhist concept, the two truths doctrine. Okay, so I used the example before about the self and no self. I'll use some other examples to help illustrate it. Almost everything you could say, not only in Buddhism, but in philosophy in general, I can find a way to show that it's false, or I could find a way to show that it's true. And it really depends on the complexities of the circumstances, and it depends on what level you're speaking on. So, for example, you've heard of the constellation called the Big Dipper, right? I've mentioned this before in other talks, but the Big Dipper. Is the Big Dipper real? Now, in one sense, it's not just made up. Somebody didn't just lie to you when they told you there was a Big Dipper. You know, it's not just a complete fantasy. But at the other sense, is it like that cushion? Or is it just a label we put on a bunch of stars in the sky? We decided which stars were included in that, which ones weren't. There's all kinds of stars everywhere. And then we said, well, to us, it looks like a dipper. So we'll call it the Big Dipper. But does that make the Big Dipper real? In one sense, it's not real because it's just a bunch of stars, and we just use it as a quick way to get our bearing when we're trying to figure out where the stars are, right? So it's... You could say it's an illusion. So on the plain, conventional truth, you would say, yeah, there's a Big Dipper. Here it is. Look, I'll open up a book and I'll show you where it is. I can tell you where in the sky it is. I can look, point to it. There it is. You can't deny it. There's the Big Dipper right there. But that's a simpler level of truth. The ultimate truth is that each of those stars is just, they're different distances from us. So they're not even really aligned like a dipper. They're only aligned like a dipper because from Earth's vantage point, they line up that way. If we got in a spaceship and we went to another star system, the stars would move like this, and now the dipper's gone, you know. So there's the simple truth. And then the simple truth isn't necessarily worthless. It's very important sometimes to have those conventional truths, because the conventional truths, just like with science, science isn't worthless or bad because it's only the tip of the iceberg or it's simplistic or whatever. Science is very helpful. Science allows us to have lights in here. Science has allowed us to make cures for diseases and airplanes. It's a very helpful tool. And we can do a lot of neat things by using these quick sort of rules of thumb, these quick shortcuts. Because you don't want to have a huge philosophical enlightenment before you could do anything in the world. You have to be able to eat and wear clothes. You know, you have to be able to do things. So you need these little shortcuts. They're like macros on a computer, you know. And the Big Dipper is very helpful because you can say, oh, okay, well, if the Big Dipper's there, then this star's there, and you can figure out the layout of the stars very easily. So, and it is true. It is true that those stars are lined up in that way that a person can associate in their mind with a dipper. But that truth, when you get to understanding the ultimate truth, you see that that truth is based on something subjective. It's the reality isn't outside of our minds. It's a reality in our minds. We made those connections. And what's really interesting is when you start to go further and further and you see that the cushion is just like the Big Dipper. Yes, those particles are next to each other, unlike the Big Dipper. But there's also space between those particles. And those particles aren't always going to be associated with that cushion. They just happen to be right now. If our sense of time scale were accurate to the billions of years of the universe, this is just two cars passing on a road, and they're lined up like that, and then they're no longer aligned. So if we really understood truth the way our subconscious can understand it, the way we can directly experience it, then we wouldn't cry when the cushion gets tore up or somebody steals it and get all upset. And we do things that end lives and cause severe consequences because of fighting over this cushion. And so that's the function of the ultimate truth. Yeah. Does that help explain the difference between conventional and ultimate truth?
I've had a conversation with someone about this also, an easy way to show the two truths is that, say, if something hurts, like your arm hurts, there's the truth of this hurts. There's also the truth of there's a number of different sensations that cause this to happen and are also happening at the same time.
I really like that. What I like about that a lot is that it points to things like how we get carried away with just one aspect of things. Oh, sure. Do you want to?
Like, there's an example of the two truths. If you hit something and there's pain, there's a truth of this hurts. But then there's also the other truth of there's a number of different sensations that are causing this and also happening at the same time. Like, there's a bunch of, there's a reaction to these sensations that you're not aware of while you're also thinking this hurts.
That's an interpretation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And first is the interpretation, and the second is the sensation that we've kind of just.
And it's really amazing, too. Some experiments have shown how widely our perception of pain can vary based on our ideas and our thoughts. You can actually really deal with pain in a lot of ways that are very surprising, that are not even medicinal, that are just, you know, based on perception. I was reading an article about when people expect to have a lot of pain, they preempt it and they get themselves ready and they go, oh, that's so terrible. But when they just say, no, I won't do this, and they get up and they just, you know, act like it's not going to happen, it kind of doesn't happen. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And of course, there's limits to that, you know, and it takes practice and all that kind of thing. But it's just fascinating. And what I also like about your example is that it illustrates how right understanding can help to begin to divorce and split apart our impulse drives from us. So something happens and people say, oh, that person made me so angry. As if it was just an automatic mechanism. They did this and it made me angry. You know, of course I'm angry because they made me angry. They're unaware, or they're not paying attention to the fact that that was a choice. And so as you start to understand the pain of the arm more, you start to understand your own mind, and like you're sitting in meditation and you feel like you got to sneeze, and then you realize, I don't have to sneeze. And then you just say no, and it goes away. Sometimes. But when it does, then you're going to realize those are just suggestions. When your brain tells you, oh, aren't you angry about that? Look what that guy did. Aren't you mad about that? Or, hey, there's an itch over here. Don't you need to scratch it? Or, aren't you hungry? Don't you want that donut? Those are just, you can say, you know, you don't have to be, that's not you. The people that are wrapped up in it, they think that's them. That's how I am. That's just how I am. Yep, I'll always be like that. That's me, trapped in that. But that's not you. And so those insights of what we're talking about, what's right now just a very kind of like abstracted conversation, it can lead, the more you think about it, it can lead to these insights, and you start to see the split. You start to see that space between you and that little lizard brain that's trying to make you do things. I went to the Bodhi Center on one of the retreats Julie and I did, and it was a tough challenge for us because even though I've been meditating a long time, you know, this is different. You know, you wake up real early, you go and you meditate all day, and I'm not used to sitting for that long in that posture and everything. And I often like to tell people it's not really about some kind of athletic thing you're trying to do with being able to sit with your legs crossed. That's not really important. What's important is what's going on here. But having said that, the trying to deal with that discomfort taught me something very important, and probably the most important thing I learned from that whole retreat was that I had been not seeing something that I now see. The thing I hadn't seen is I would feel discomfort, and I would feel like, oh, I need to readjust or do something, you know, I need to react to it, you know. And all I saw in my mind was that there was discomfort, and I was having to resist it. I was like, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. But what I didn't see was the sneaky little, what came in my mind to be represented as a little salamander. And so the salamander is this is the suggestion that I must react to the pain, react to the discomfort. And so inevitably, and I started to laugh at the salamander because he's so predictable. So you sit there, everything's fine, there's the grass, and sooner or later he starts coming up. And he's moving through the grass, he's trying to be sneaky, he doesn't want you to see him. Because if you don't see the salamander, and he comes up, and he tells you, you need to react to that, then you'll just go, oh, react to it. But if you see him coming and you feel him rising up, starting to rise up, it was the identification and the labeling of that impulse to give in or react to pain. Not the pain. I was focused on the pain before. But it's the suggestion that I must react to it. That's what I labeled that I had never labeled before. And by recognizing that impulse, I could see it rising up in myself. I learned something about the mechanisms going on in here. I could see it rising up in myself. And when I saw it, I could just go, in my mind, didn't necessarily have to raise my hand, but in my mind, I just go, and I'm more powerful than the salamander. It's just a salamander, and he has to go away. And then he comes back with a slink, and a little bit more later, I just do that, it goes away. And I started to smile while I was meditating because it was so funny, but it was also such a simple little thing. But your mind has all kinds of little things in it going on like that all the time. And the more we meditate, the more we start to understand our minds. And then we start to gain mastery. I think we're out of time. Oh, that's a shame. I really love this presentation. She didn't even give me a minute before the next presentation. We got two here. Okay, why don't you go first? Oh, thank you. Right, and even more importantly than when you're sitting in a room, when you're out in your life and something happens and you're like, what do you mean? Get away from me! You don't do that because you see it rising and you're aware of what's going on. Sure. And the aims of science are slightly different than the aims of Buddha, are very different. In science, you're just trying to get data about the external functioning of systems and things. In Buddhism, we have an internal thing we're doing, which is a different set of operations. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you, everybody. Really appreciate it.